Last week we saw that after teaching about the kingdom of God in parables, in chapter 4, Jesus then showed that he had the power to bring in that kingdom by demonstrating his power over the three most powerful sources of chaos. Because remember, this is a competing gospel that we are continually learning about in Mark. Rome taught about their own gospel, their own way of bringing in peace. They used the same word, euangelion, that we translate as gospel. Their good news was that the military was spreading their empire, that Roman culture was spreading, that everything was becoming how they wanted it to be. They taught that their highest god, Jupiter, had blessed them, and that they would have the civilization that lasts through all of time. And in this world, to this culture, the gospel writers were not unaware of what they were saying. They said, Jesus' kingdom is the true kingdom. He is the true Messiah, the one who is bringing in the kingdom that will last forever. And as he went away from teaching about the fact that he will bring in this kingdom, he then showed that he could do what Rome could not do. Because in that day, to the ancient understanding, chaos had to be conquered for an empire to spread. And what Jesus went and did is he conquered the sea, and then he conquered demons, and then he conquered death, the three most potent sources of chaos in the world. He conquered them to show that he, not Rome, had the power. And we talked about how this was a beautiful foreshadowing of the fact that he came as the greater deliverer promised in Isaiah to conquer the greatest enemy, the enemy that needed to be conquered, death and our sin. And he triumphed over those and trampled those through his victory on the cross. And as we continue to think about this kingdom, as we continue to think about what this kingdom will need, what we're going to see in chapter 6, as we will look at all of chapter 6, we're going to see that not only Jesus has the power to bring in this kingdom of God, but also that he is the leader that this kingdom needs. As we look to chapter 6, I'm not going to reread what was read for the scripture reading. We're going to first look at 6 verses 1 through 6. And the first thing that you see as you think about this kingdom theme that's being developed is that Jesus is rejected in his own hometown. The first thing we see as we look is that he taught in the synagogue and many were astonished, which sounds great. We think of earlier where the crowd is astonished, said, what new teaching is this? What new authority is this? And we think maybe this is a good thing. But we see quickly that this astonishment turns to offense. And the Greek behind this word offense has the idea of shock and anger. It's made even more clear in the book of Luke where they try to take him to a cliff and kill him. But that's not Mark's focus here. His focus here is rather on their dismissal and their lack of belief. Their remarks about Jesus boil down to saying, who is he to claim such wisdom and power? If you look at the verses here, they say, where did this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary? We have to keep in mind that Jesus has been doing ministry in Galilee for a while now, but we actually haven't read that he's done ministry in his own hometown yet. So it's likely that they've heard of many of the things that he has done. And in their mind, they're struggling with the fact that we know this guy. He's just a carpenter, which we read the word, and by the way, sorry to burst anybody's bubble, but we're not actually sure he was a carpenter. The word just means tradesman. So just think a blue-collar worker. That's what he was. And they also say, we know his mom, we know his family. Now, we are uncertain about his father, Joseph, because his father, Joseph, beyond the birth narratives, is not mentioned. So it is believed that Joseph died at some point during his childhood. But we see in the parallel accounts that they say, is this not son of Joseph? Because the cultural norm was to refer to a child by the father. To say, is this not son of Mary, is likely picking up on the fact that there is a stigma still in place against him and what is alleged his illegitimate birth. So to say, is this not son of Mary, is really a slam against his character and the circumstances of his birth. It is a dismissal due to scorn, is what Mark is trying to point out. After all, he is just a carpenter, a tradesman. He's just a normal blue-collar worker, the son of an illegitimate birth. We know him and his family. It can't be him. They refuse to have faith in him. And then he told them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown. And there's more given about that in Luke and other parallel accounts. But mostly what we focus on here is that he marveled at their unbelief and their rejection. And it's a theme purposely that Mark is picking up to lead us into something that we're about to read shortly in this chapter. And then we read that he could do no mighty work there. Do not read that as a statement of ability. He could. He could do any mighty work that he wanted to. He is choosing not to because of what is going on. The fact that they are refusing to have faith and they're scorning him. He refuses to be a miracle salesman. He refuses to be like the pagan magicians. He refuses to prove to them simply by showing them something fancy enough. So he could, because healing and miracles is not normally done without morally directed faith and trust. That's what he's looking for from everybody that he interacts with. Do you have faith? Do you have belief? And he refuses to simply act to impress them. Despite this, we read almost in passing in verse 5, he could do no mighty work there except that he laid his hands on a few people and healed them. Except that he did this major miracle of actually healing a few people. But Mark says it dismissively. And I think when you read that, you should think, maybe those are people who actually did faith. I also think it's legitimate to just read some compassion into there. He sees the suffering around him and can't help but to alleviate at least some of it before he moves on. But in the very next verse, he went about among the villages teaching. So despite the lack of faith, he does heal a few people, but then he goes and out and continues to teach among the surrounding villages. And then the next thing we read, starting in starting in verse 7 through 13, is that Jesus commissions and sends out the 12 apostles in pairs. I don't think this is accidental that this is placed here right after a rejection of his authority and his identity. After preaching in some towns, he calls the 12 apostles to him and sends them out in pairs to do ministry, as a testimony had to be confirmed by two or more people. So that's why he sent them in pairs, as it's ancient tradition that two or more people have to be there to confirm the testimony. And the fact that we read, immediately after this rejection of authority, he called them and gave them authority over unclean spirits. If you're going to give somebody authority, you have to have authority in the first place to give it. So they had just rejected him, and then he goes and does something that he can only do because he does have the authority to do it. So he goes and sends out the apostles. And by sending them out with nothing, he is forcing them to rely on God and the help of others. He is also calling them to walk in the footsteps of Elijah and John the Baptist and their reliance on God for provision. It is not an accident, by the way, that we have a theme already of a prophet rejected by his own people, and then also kind of this theme of reliance on God and not having much to live on, surviving off of help from others and the land. Kind of sounds like John the Baptist. That's on purpose. We're leading into things here in Mark. And then he also, we read this instruction here about, starting in verse 10, whenever you enter a house, stay there until you depart from there, and if any place will not receive you and they will not listen to you when you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet as a testimony against them. The only thing we have that's like remotely close in our culture to that is cleaning off your muddy boots when you come into somebody's house before you put them in the shoe area. That's about the closest thing we have. So this cultural practice here that's happening, we might completely miss. And there are different things that are related to this cultural practice that includes a renunciation, a saying, I am separate from what I am distancing myself from and shaking off of myself. It's also severed relationships. It is judgment. I don't want to be a part of the judgment that's coming to this thing that the ground is associated with. But probably most accurately, it's going from godless ground to holy ground. Because very strict Jews would shake off the dirt from their feet when stepping from Gentile territory to Israelite territory, or when stepping from common ground to the temple complex. So this is likely a statement that says when they are leaving this town, they are leaving a godless area, an area that is godless because it has rejected God's message. And then the narrative turns suddenly to John the Baptist. And I'm going to start reading in verse 14, and we're going to go all the way to verse 29. King Herod heard of this, for Jesus' name had become known. Some said, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. That is why he has miraculous powers, and they are at work in him. But others said, he is Elijah. And others said, he is a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. For it was Herod who had sent and seized John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death, but she could not. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he kept him safe. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he heard him gladly. But an opportunity came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for the nobles and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. For when Herodias' daughter came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, "Ask for me whatever you wish, and I will give it to you." And he vowed to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give you, up to half the kingdom." And she went out and said to her mother, "For what should I ask?" And she said, "The head of John the Baptist." And she came in immediately with haste to the king and said, saying, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." And the king was exceedingly sorry, but because of his oaths and his guests, he did not want to break his word to her. And immediately the king sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison and brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl. And the girl gave it to her mother. And when his disciples heard of it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb. So the narrative of this, the mission and the ministry of Jesus, is seemingly interrupted by this account of Herod hearing about Jesus and then what is actually a flashback to the time of his death. This did not happen at this time. You can look at the parallel accounts and try to fit it in chronological order better there. That's not Mark's purpose. Mark's purpose is to remind us right now of what happened because of what he's developing in this chapter. So first and foremost, there are two things that he's doing with this flashback here. First, he is sending out he's putting the account of the sending out of the apostles and their returning, because the very next thing you read after this account is the returning of the gospels. So he sandwiches this account with the sending out and the returning to give a sobering reminder of the potential cost of ministry for Jesus. And second, this account can be described as a banquet of death given by one who claimed to be the king of the Jews, which perfectly sets up the reader for an account that we're going to read next, which is a feast or a banquet of life given by Jesus, who is the real king. This Herod here, by the way, is not Herod the Great from the birth account of Jesus. I know it's confusing because they keep claiming the name Herod. Not the same guy, though. This Herod is one of his sons, Herod Antipas, who was technically not actually a king. He was a tetrarch, because after Herod the Great, Herod the Great put in his will that the kingdom was split between his four children. And the kingdom had been divided into four sections. Herod Antipas rules the Galilean area. Mark most likely calls him a king here, partly to match the imagery of the chapter, setting up the opposing king's imagery, but then also possibly an irony, because remember, this was written later, and actually later in history, so before Mark was written, Antipas and Herodias later worked together to appeal to the title of king, which led to a war, which led to his banishment. So his hubris, his pride, trying to go above what had been given to him, led to his banishment. And I want to give a little brief history as we think about the Herods here. Around 100 BC, the Judean ruler, which if you're into history, the Hasmonean rulers, but the Judean rulers, so Israelite area, the Judean ruler conquered Edom. And if you remember Edom from all of Caleb's work that he did for geography in the Joshua, it's like southeast of Israel across the river, descendants of Esau. So the Judean rulers conquered Edom, forced them to convert to Judaism, and then integrated them into Jewish society. By around 50 BC, so about 50 years later, Rome had appointed the Herodians, who were Edomites, as leaders in Judea. The Parthians then invaded in 40 BC, and the Judean kingship was then restored as a pro-Parthian monarchy. So the Judean monarchy was pro-Parthian. But then Herod the Great escaped from this and fled to Rome, convinced Rome of his allegiance, and gained their support to establish the Herodian kingship back by 37 BC, and he extended it over the Edomite and Judean area. I say all this briefly, one, because history is fascinating, but also, two, to show that yes, the Herods did support Rome, and they were under the Roman authority, but they also had been integrated into Jewish society, claimed to follow Jewish religion, in part, if you know a lot about Herod, and claimed to be king of the Jews. Remember the thing that's put on Jesus' cross? The Herods claimed that title, especially Herod the Great. And this is all very important for what is to follow. Herod Antipas had arrested John the Baptist for his opposition, as we read, to Herod's marriage to Herodias, he arrested him because John's opposition threatened Herodias' position and acceptance as queen among the people, or Tetrarch's wife, if you want to be proper. If her name, Herodias, by the way, didn't give it away, she is the granddaughter of Herod the Great. Her first husband was Philip, the son of Herod the Great, by a different mother, and she had divorced him to marry Herod Antipas, who was the son of Herod the Great by yet a different mother. They were both her step-uncles. He, in turn, had divorced his wife to marry Herodias. John the Baptist was obviously opposed to this on many levels, and told him so. Herodias wanted John killed, but Herod was afraid to do that, and he also enjoyed talking to John, even though he didn't agree with him. On Herod's birthday, though, he gave a banquet for the leading men of Galilee. He had Herodias' daughter, so his daughter, who was likely a minor, dance. And adults, that's an innuendo. For him and the men. The dance pleased him and the men so much that he offered her up for half of the, that he offered her up to half of the kingdom. He didn't have authority, by the way, but what this meant is that he just gave her anything he had the ability to give her. The daughter then goes to Herodias, her mom, who tells her to ask for the head of John the Baptist to be served on a platter. And what this means is that it means to be displayed at the feast. That's why the platter is mentioned. So the head of John the Baptist to be served on a platter, to which Herod reluctantly had to agree because he couldn't break his word in front of the guests. If you feel like you need a shower after reading that, that's the point. This is the guy who claims to be king of the Jews. The king of the Jews, the shepherd of the people, is vulgar, extremely immoral, corrupt, abusive, giving a feast of sin and death, featuring the death of God's prophet. Before we go any further, it would be really nice to say that we've gotten past stuff like this as a people and as a culture. But every year, there is case after case of powerful men and women taking advantage of their wealth and their power to abuse and hurt others, to commit vulgar sins and corruption, especially when they are leaders, and especially when they claim the name of Christ. We, like John, have every right to call them out and every right to call for justice. We see it in business, in politics, yes, on both sides of the aisle, and revealed in part by the growing evidence of the Epstein files. And unfortunately, even in churches and in Christian leaders, if you follow the news at all these last few years, we have seen so many church leaders be exposed for what they have done. These things ought not be so. The consistent message of the Bible is that with power and authority comes the extra responsibility and accountability to use it well and to use it for the good of others. Even if they don't agree with you, even if they don't look like you, even if they're not part of your culture, whoever they are, we see the call consistently throughout the Bible to lead with grace and with justice and compassion and equity. And in the rest of this chapter and in the rest of Mark, we're going to see through the words and the actions of Jesus what true leadership looks like. As we continue, we're going to look next at verses 30 through 44 that are going to start to show this to us. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest for a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in a boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot, and all the towns, from all the towns, and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. And he took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men, and the other accounts say plus women and children. So after this flashback account to Herod's banquet, we read that the apostles turned to give their report to Jesus, and he recommended that they all go together to a desolate place, for they, the leaders of this group we read, had no leisure even to eat. And I love that that detail is thrown in there, because you see Herod and the other Gentile leaders, which, by the way, read that Gentile leaders, those are the people. The people who happened to be an influence, though, and in agreement with Herod. Those leaders had plenty of leisure to eat and to do vile things. But the leaders of Jesus' movement had no leisure. And he says, let's go away to a desolate place. The crowd, though, saw them trying to get away and followed them, meeting when they went ashore. You can imagine the sigh from Jesus and the disciples. Trying to get away to a desolate place, and they see this massive crowd just following them on foot, meeting them. And they step ashore and just look to an expectant crowd. Jesus, when he saw them, had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. This phrase here, by the way, is not a throwaway phrase. It's very intentional. We just read what the current leader or the current shepherd in the imagery that's spread all throughout the Old Testament, that the leaders of Israel are shepherds. We just read what the current shepherd was doing. And we are reading now, and we see the compassion that Jesus as a shepherd has. And if Ezekiel 34 and other passages aren't popping into your mind yet, then you've kind of missed what Mark is trying to say. Sheep without a shepherd is a very common Old Testament expression used to describe Israel's inadequate and oppressive leadership. See, especially Ezekiel 34. If you want to, I'd really encourage you to go read that as a supplement to the sermon here. And we read also in Ezekiel that God had promised to send a better shepherd. Because what have the shepherds always been called to in the Old Testament? To seek justice, to love mercy, and to treat others well. None of which had just been exhibited by the leadership. As the day grew late, the disciples suggested that they send the people out to the surrounding villages to get food for themselves, which the detail there, villages, is important because at that time it was popular that any one village in the area had a maximum occupancy of like maybe 3,000 people. The crowd itself is bigger than all of the surrounding villages each individually are. So they would have to have time to go scatter and spread throughout the villages to get the food they need. Jesus, though, tells them to feed the people even though they don't have the food or money to do so. They present him with 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he has the people sit in by hundreds and fifties. He then blesses the food, has the disciples pass it out, and then when they do, they have enough for everybody with 12 baskets left over after feeding over 5,000 people from 5 loaves and 2 fish. All of the details included in Mark's telling of this story are purposely shaped to bring certain Old Testament images to mind. Did you notice that one that he sneaks in there? But when he has them sit down, he commanded them to all sit down in groups on the green grass. Just Psalm 23, just going to sprinkle that in there. And there are not just Psalm 23 images, but there's so much that he's trying to bring to your mind in what he's saying. First and foremost, there is so much shepherd imagery here from Psalm 23 and the other shepherd passages that I literally don't have time to go through it all. In fact, I did, though. You can go back to 2021. There's a sermon that I did on this chapter that walks through all of this, the shepherd imagery, and compares it to all the other shepherd passages. It's part of the Good Shepherd sermon series that I did a few years ago. So if you want more shepherd imagery stuff, you can go listen to that. There's also a purposeful allusion to a similar miracle that Elisha did in 2 Kings 4, which I totally didn't remember about when I was studying this. A commentator mentioned it, and I'm like, that happened? It's like 3 verses long. But in that passage, Elisha provides food for more than 100 men from 20 loaves and a few ears of grain with food left over. And has the same exact interaction with his disciples where they're like, well, this is all we have. You want us to feed 100 people? And he's like, yeah, go do it. So they do it and there's food left over. It's like literally the same story, but Jesus does it on a grander scale. The other major allusion, though, is to God's provision of manna in the wilderness during the Exodus flight from Egypt. that the people here, we read, I think twice specified that they're in a desolate place. We read they're in need of food. And then we also read that they're arranged in groups, which actually alludes to Exodus 18, Moses arranging the people in groups as they traveled throughout the wilderness. And then also that they have 12 baskets left over. There's a lot of debate about numbers, but I think this one is the most clear, and I'll talk about the other one when we get to it. 12 baskets, wilderness theme, manna imagery, Jesus greater Moses. I think the 12 might mean the 12 tribes. And remember how I talked about earlier about Jesus commissioning 12 apostles was a common cultural thing going on at that time, that if you had a group of 12 in your group, you were saying that our group is a new or renewed or renewal of Israel. It's more 12 imagery saying that his group, his teaching, his kingdom is the true and the renewal for Israel. So whether it is Good Shepherd imagery or greater prophet imagery or greater Moses imagery, Jesus stands in all of these. The important thing to note is that in all of these comparisons, he stands in the place of God. Because in the shepherd imagery, it's constantly pointing to a greater shepherd who does these things. And you can't miss the imagery here that Mark's saying, yeah, this one, Jesus, he's the greater shepherd. And then the Elisha imagery, it's purposeful that the miracle is a super expansion of Elisha. But not only that, but in the Elisha account, Elisha says, the Lord will do this. Jesus just looks up, prays, and gives it, putting himself in the place of the Lord. And then Moses prays and intercedes with God, and then God provides the manna and gives the instructions for the manna, and Jesus just provides the food. We've talked about this before, how Jesus is doing miracles and teaching and everything so directly to make the point that he himself is standing in the place of God. So we've seen from the first banquet in this chapter how far the king and the leadership of Israel has gone astray. And now in the second banquet, we see that the promised king has come to bring his people into a new exodus and a new kingdom. Because that's the point of all this Moses and Israel and wilderness and manna imagery. A new exodus has come. These themes are heightened and added in what happens next immediately after this. So we're going to read in verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into a boat and go before him to the other side to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat went out to sea, and he was alone on land. And when he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them, and it was about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea, and he meant to pass them by. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost, and cried out. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded. For they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So Jesus tells his disciples to go in a boat to the other side while he dismisses the crowd and goes up to a mountain to pray, trying to get finally some alone time, which you see Jesus do a lot when he's been very busy. Also, don't miss the imagery here that, let's see, it's starting here. And, oh, there we go. So when he dismissed the crowd and he had taken them to... And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on a mountain to pray. All this Moses imagery, and then you also have Jesus going up on a mountain to pray or meet with God. That's a purposeful another layer to this Moses imagery that's happening here. And as a quick aside here, if you followed in that, you'll notice he tells them to go Bethsaida, but then in verse 53, in the starting of the next section, we read that they land in Gennesaret, and you're like, man, were these guys like really struggling with directions? If you harmonize all the gospel accounts, I talked through this in Sunday school when we talked about it, but if you harmonize all the gospel accounts, you can get the full logistics. That's not the point in Mark. Like, you can find the logistics later. The logistics are not the point of the passage here. But there's a reason why that all happens. Anyway, the wind was against them. And by the fourth watch of the night, they are still rowing very hard against the wind. So we went out to them, walking on the water, and we read that he meant to pass them by. But they saw him, and they didn't recognize him, and they were utterly terrified. Which, by the way, there is a possibility here, I was reading into culture stuff, that there was a mariner's myth that if people died at sea, their ghost stayed above the place where they had died. So there is a possibility here, because they're fishermen and would likely be aware of these mariner's myths, that they are dealing with a ghost of some deceased fisherman or somebody who was on the water and died there, and their ghost is hanging out over that spot. So like they're understandably terrified. But he says to them, "Take heart, it is I," which the Greek there is I am. Do not be afraid. When he gets into the boat, the wind ceases, and they are utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. You read that, and you see the closing there. They did not understand about the loaves, and their hearts were hardened. You read that, and your initial reaction might be, I think the loaves were the farthest thing from their mind at that point. So why are the loaves parted or signaled out here as what they didn't understand? Because I'm pretty sure if I was in that situation, I would be like, a guy just walked on water. I'm not thinking about bread. But why is the bread important? Why is it said that they missed the point because they missed the point of the loaves? We already noticed that this account began with Moses and Elijah imagery as Jesus was going up the mountain to pray to meet with God. And then the next allusion that we see in the text is him meaning to pass them by. That isn't just like a throwaway humor comment. That is purposeful biblical imagery that's picking up on three major biblical images. In Exodus 33 to 34, we read that the glory of God passes by Moses while God hides him in the cleft of the rock. While he passes Moses, he reveals his character and his name. In 1 Kings 19, we read that the Lord passes by Elijah as he gives him comfort, strength, and purpose. And then lastly, and very significantly, in Job 9, we read from Job that God alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. What is Jesus doing? And we read that when he passes by me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. There is a major theme in Job of God's power over chaos, which in this instance is the sea, yet also of God often not being seen or understood. In Jesus' response to the disciples' fear, we also see an allusion to Exodus 3 and God's revelation of his name, I Am, to Moses prior to the Exodus. So what does this have to do with the loaves? The promises are coming true. That's what it has to do with the loaves. Jesus provided leadership and provision for the people in the wilderness, laced with Exodus and Moses imagery, culminating with 12 leftover baskets to represent the 12 tribes. And in case that wasn't enough, he then crosses over, not through, a body of water, not through the representation of Moses or Joshua or the Ark or the prophet, but himself coming in person to his people, not on ground made dry, but himself being dry, treading on the waves of the sea, which is showing complete dominion over chaos, and declaring himself to be the I Am. He's literally putting a banner over himself saying, do you get it? The new and greater Exodus is happening right in front of him. The promised deliverer, shepherd, and king has arrived. But they didn't understand about the loaves. They didn't get it. Their hearts were hardened, which in this text, all throughout Mark, it makes clear that this is just as much on them and their own stubbornness as Jesus not explicitly revealing himself to them yet. One thing we should remember, by the way, about all this new Exodus imagery is that, especially in Ezekiel and Isaiah and elsewhere, it is made clear that the new Exodus will include people from all nations, fulfilling the promise to Abraham that his seed will be a blessing to the whole earth. And this is a theme that we're going to pick up in earnest in the next two chapters. As this chapter closes, though, we read that after they land, we read picking up in 53, when they had crossed over, they land in the land of Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they had gotten out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick on their beds to wherever they heard that he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countrysides, they laid the sick in the marketplace and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. As this kingdom closes, we read that after they land, the people, unlike the disciples on the water, immediately recognized Jesus. Now, to be fair, he was not walking on water and they didn't think it was a ghost. But that's a purposeful inclusion, I think, by Mark. Opposing views of like recognize, don't recognize. They immediately recognize him and tell everyone in the region to bring the sick to him, and as many as even touch the fringe of his garment were healed. So as you look through Mark, you can't miss the opposition that Mark is creating here about the king. In the first few verses rejected at Nazareth, you see the rejection of the king. And then in the next few verses where he sends out his apostles, you see the commissioning of the king to his representatives. And then in the death of John the Baptist, you see kingly abuse. And then in the feeding of the 5,000, you see kingly care. And then as he walks on water, he shows that he, the king, has arrived and is with his people. And then it ends with more kingly care as he heals and cares for those around him. From beginning to end of this chapter and all over the gospel, we see that Jesus demonstrates the opposite type of leadership that is demonstrated by the bad leaders, the bad shepherds of Israel. He cares for the poor and the needy and the oppressed and the marginalized. He guides them toward truth. His is not a leadership of self-satisfaction and vile indulgence, but of compassion, sacrifice, and service, often to the least of these and the ones that are held at arm length by those in power. The current leadership of God's people brought the death of God's prophet to silence the opposition to their own sins. The leadership that Jesus came to bring brings his own death to pay the price for the sins of the whole world. They might be trying to cover up their sins, the current leadership, and he says, I've come to cover the sins of the whole world by what I'm going to do. Just as Jesus saw that the people were as sheep without a shepherd and himself provided what they needed, so we also saw and see that all we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and he provided what we need. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. By his wounds we are healed. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for the example that you gave of what true leadership is, what your kingdom is really about. I pray for myself and Caleb. I pray for anybody in a position of leadership. I pray for the leaders of our nation that they will see the call, the accountability, and the responsibility of leadership, which is care and compassion and justice and mercy, not self-seeking, not self-indulgence, not in crowd gratifying, making happy only those that they agree with, but that we will see the call to true God-honoring leadership, to humble ourselves, to lead in a way that is service and is love. And I pray all this in your name. Amen.